Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, welcome to another Richard Herring Square Theatre podcast. This week's guest is Catelyn Moran. It's a really good one. I am on tour in 2017. There's a couple of dates in 2016, but the bulk of it's between February and May 2017. I'm doing a show called The Best. It's 90 minutes of what I consider to be my best stand-up. So if you're new to me and would like to see my funnier stuff, or if you would like to reminisce about the old shows, or if you'd like to bring along a friend who says I'm rubbish, then say, well, come and see this. And then if they still think I'm rubbish at the end of it, then it's not going to work out for them. But, you know, it's 90 minutes of their life and they can decide whether... I'm worth persisting with. If you go to richardherring.com/the_best/tour or richardherring.com/gigs, or just go to richardherring.com and click on the front page and you can get to all the tour dates. I'm coming to loads of places in the UK. Leicester Square Theatre in February in London, and then all over the place, and some new ones have been added quite recently. So do go and check out and buy some tickets. It's the perfect Christmas gift for all the family, apart from probably people under 15 or very old racist unpleasant people who like puns. Okay, thanks for listening. See, hope you enjoyed this podcast. Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, is it working?
Yeah.
Good. Don't patronise me. Welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who has just spent half an hour talking to a 125-year-old man, and that is true. It's Richard Herring. This one working? Is it working? That's good. Hello, welcome to the Rich Haynes Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was in Xanadu with Olivia Newton-John the other day. She had all those kind of thing round her head that's cool. She called it relastomus. I don't. That seems to be catching on. I've been doing one of my Kickstarter. I think you're going to hear a bit about Kickstarters tonight. But I've been doing one of my Kickstarter awards before you all came in, which was to have a half an hour interview with. If there's anyone who's really terrified of horrific puppets that look like they'll come alive, look away now. I've just done a. This is Ali. Don't go him like that. Hello, it's me, Ali. Look, see, he's like a real person. Can speak on its own. Doesn't even need a microphone. No, I don't need a microphone. It's fine. I've got a lapel mic on. Good. So this is the ventriloquist dummy that Stuart Lee used to. There we re. And look, Stuart Lee modelled his hair on that in the 1990s. That's the just a rub in. So I thought Ali, I might bring him in every week because he can. I think Ali can ask questions that I would be too ashamed to ask. So we'll see how that goes. But he's here for now, and he's from 1892. That's where he when he was created. So that's exciting, isn't it? So anyway, look, we haven't got all that long with the first guest, not as long as usual. So I will crack straight on. So are you back in the box? Oh, I don't want to go in the box. Well, you're in the box, so. His my great-granddad made him, and then my granddad had him, and then passed it down to me. My great-granddad was a Methodist minister and used him to teach parables and stuff. I use him to make jokes about being wanked up, you know, like to reveal true life stories. So anyway, my guest tonight is probably best known from being a guest on Pagina 2, or Pagina 2, I don't know how you pronounce it. It's like vagina with a P. But she was also on Sunday Brunch in 2012. That's where you may. That's probably where you'll recognise her from. Will you please welcome Catelyn Moran, ladies and gentlemen? Here comes Catelyn Moran. Beautiful. Thank you very much. I hope you don't mind this box of Victorian toys between us.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to see it now.
Did not see
build
it.
Up.
There's two, actually, so I can show. That's Ali.
Oh, Christ. Actually, I've been in a similar situation. I once spent an hour and a half trying to interview Marky Smith from the Fall. It wasn't entirely visually dissimilar.
This is Sally, who I think is actually more scary.
I mean, I did look a lot like that when I was 18, to be fair. That was very much the hairstyle I had.
Like, a lot of her teeth have come out. I just noticed today when I was talking to her today. I think that's my fault. I was meant to look after these, and my granddad gave them to me. But they are very old. They're very old. There's some newspaper in. This is some newspaper that was inside them. That's from 1892.
I hope it just says war. I just presume all old newspapers say war declared. That's.
I think they. I don't know if there was the Boer War was
what
around.
What is this? I know it's got a little list of things that you can buy. Apparently they had a special on chlorate of potash. That was one shilling. Seems quite reasonable. I don't know what potash is now. Borax, soda bicarb, soda mint. This is good shit, man. I'm like, this is my new shopping list.
Fantastic. What was Pagina or Pagina 2? Do you remember being on that?
I don't know.
I think it was talk show in Spain or something.
Christ, I don't remember that at all. I remember doing a talk show that was feminism in the early 90s, and it was me, Jermaine Greer, Suzanne Moore, and Miranda Sawyer.
Right.
And we were all around a riding table. And because it was about feminism, it might as well have been called Vagina 2. And there was a bottle in the centre of the table, and it was the days when you could smoke fags as well, so I was immediately tabbing away because I was very nervous in 18. And everybody was pouring themselves drinks from this decanter. And I'd never come across sherry before. I just thought you could drink it like wine, so I was drinking like half pints of sherry, knocking it back like a beast, and smoking fags at the same time. And all the way through, I was the only one who was smoking. And towards the end, everybody started talking about their mothers and got really emotional. And as they started talking about their mothers, you saw every single woman's hand shoot to the centre of the table, take fags out of my packet, and everyone just started smoking again. My bloody mother, my bloody mother. And that's feminism.
That's what it's the mothers that make you feminist. That's what happens.
Absolutely,
that's
yes.
As is my understanding of feminism.
Yeah. Richard, could you take your box off the table?
Why?
It's obscuring the view, apparently.
Okay.
The amount of times I've been told to take my box off the table. There's so many dinner parties.
How's that? Is that all right for you? Is that obscure? Is it like what's? Is it the crotch shot that we that you're worried about? Good. It's great to have you on. Well, you know, we'll talk about the Kickstarter straight away because you're kickstarting Raised by Wolves, which is your you did two series on Channel 4 of your sitcom, and basically sort of about your family, I would imagine, fairly strongly, although set in the present day.
Yeah, yeah. So I was the eldest of eight children. We were home educated in a council house in Wolverhampton by parents who believed that the apocalypse was going to happen quite soon. And, you know, when you live through it, it's quite traumatic. But 20 years later, you think, I can make a show out of this. So so I wrote the show with my sister. It went very well. We won lots of awards and stuff. And then, as is often the way of things, it wasn't refreshed. I think it's the option wasn't refreshed for a third season. So we sort of announced it on Twitter and kind of went, oh, well, that's it, off. I've been working on this idea of doing a musical about the life of Bill Murray for like the last 5 years. So I was like, great, just don't need to write the sitcom anymore. Time for the Bill Murray musical, which I can tell you all, I mean, literally tell you scene by scene about the whole thing if anybody wants it. It's called Billennium, okay? And the idea is, you know, when they were going to have the Millennium Bug and they didn't know what was going to happen, but they thought it was going to be awful. So we joined Bill Murray on the evening, New Year's Eve, 1999. We don't know what's going to happen with the Millennium Bug. And it gets to midnight and nothing seems to be happening. He's just in the bathroom looking in the mirror, kind of, hey, well, nothing happened there. But obviously he'll improvise something funnier, because that's the great thing about working with Bill Murray. You don't have to write a script. He just does it himself. And then he goes back out into the party and looks around the room, and oh my God, everyone in the world has turned into Bill Murray. This is what the Millennium Bug is. I haven't really got much further than that, but I just like the idea of a world filled with Bill Murrays, and we've got to make it soon because he's going to die. So I was like, I can get on with that. But
Know anything specifically that's going to kill him?
Seems fairly healthy and hale. But you know, at some point, Father Time will call him back to his breast. So I was like, I'll work on Billennium instead. But then we sort of talked about it on Twitter, and loads of people were going, no, it's 2016. Loads of people love your show. Why don't you crowdfund it? So we went, okay, let's do a Kickstarter. Let's crowdfund it. Oh my God, it's knackering doing a crowdfunder, isn't it? It is.
It's very difficult. Well, it's like we were saying backstage, I've done a few and not quite as ambitious as yours. So I did one for Me One versus Me Two Snooker, which was more ambitious, where I tried to raise £1 million to play myself at snooker in my basement. I got to 106,000. But I think the people who were donating £5,000 knew their money was quite safe. So they, and some of them are like Andy McCaich, I think. They put £5,000 in and then got a call from the fraud squad because they still checked you've got the funds in your account and thought you were trying to, which is quite a good thing. Yeah, you got your card stopped, so that the joke was on you. But yeah, so it's quite an ambitious target. But I think you'll make it because I think the looking at the shape of it. But it's annoying because people in the middle, they stop doing it.
Yes.
And then why don't they just give you the money now and stop you, so you're not having a heart attack for a month?
I know, it does make you turn into a really unpleasant person. Yeah. You are essentially asking people for money, and when they don't, you get angry. And that's an unreasonable response from a very weak human being. But you know, the idea is, if people want us to make more, then if you pay us up front rather than buying the DVD at the end, we'll make more. If not, Billennium is go. Like, kind of,
well, all my options are open. That sounds so good. People are going to start taking their money out and putting it into...
Well, so long as people understand Billennium so far, I've only got the first 7 minutes. After that, I would have to crowdfund ideas. But it's a strong 7-minute opener.
Well, but it shows how much TV costs. So, like, £350,000 is sort of about how much a regular TV show
costs. It is extraordinary how much TV costs. And then you realise when you go onto the set of something, like when we were filming ours, that, like, kind of, it is like a small army of people. You are employing a small village. And they are also incredible people. Whenever I used to watch people doing kind of acceptance speeches when they'd won awards, and they were going, of course, it's the cast and crew. You're like, family, you guys make miracles happen every day. And you're like, no, I don't think they did. Like, kind of, I think they just did some catering. Kind of, you're really over-egging that. But when you've been on the set of a TV show, I mean, you hear the stories from the production people and the runners, like, you know, when you get production assistant just talking about how they were filming in mountains in Transylvania and had to get gluten-free muffins for Tom Cruise and plus smuggle his dog into the country. You think, my God, if they put a production manager in charge of any war or conflict in the world, they could sort the whole thing out in 20 minutes flat. Like, these are super organised people.
Yeah.
So those are the people that we want to employ. And plus, we're, you know, I basically won my career in a competition. I entered the Observer Young Reporter of the Year competition when I was 15. Because if you live on a council estate in Wolverhampton, it doesn't occur to you that you could come to London and have these exciting jobs. So you kind of need to be invited. So we're doing these paid internships so that people can come and work on the show in production. We're going to do writing workshops so that people who come from a similar background as us can have a hand sort of put out to them and go, come and join us. This could be fun.
Yeah.
Come and do a series, two series for a major broadcaster, and then have to kickstart it for the third. That's the kind of job I want to invite you to. I mean,
there's lots of of interesting things about this. I mean, A, that this, the series was cancelled and then you won the Palme d'Or.
Yes, I know.
It was just be quite satisfying.
I know. Oh, it did. Yes, it was very satisfying.
It's a big deal. And it's, I mean, it, you know, TV companies, the broadcasters have to make decisions and they've got to bring in new shows and there's all sorts of things to consider.
Yeah, well, you have to be noble. I mean, it's like being dumped, basically. Yeah. You can't, like, turn up at Channel 4's doorstep and just cry through their letterbox drunk in your underwear going, take me back! Why did you drop me? Because after the first 2 days, they do move you on. Yeah. That is inadvisable.
It's hard to get more than two. For a long time, I never had more than two series of anything. I've got on. This is the 10th series of this, but only because I decide whether it comes back again. And up to an extent, you. In terms of if you don't turn up, I probably would stop it. If there was literally no one here and no guest, I probably wouldn't do it.
Would you though?
But though, having said that, I did just talk to a ventriloquist dummy for half an hour on my own. So who knows what would happen. But, I mean, I think what's quite interesting about TV sitcoms is that a lot of... They're bringing in lots of people from different areas that don't usually write sitcoms, I think. And a lot of them are women. So there's Fleabag.
Yeah,
and there's,
God, I love that.
Chewing
that
Gum.
Yes.
And they've both come through a sort of theatrical background.
Yes.
And you've come to write a sitcom through, like, a journalist.
Journalism and just generally being around and having a huge face. Yeah, no. Well, this is the great thing. It's funny because, I mean, you know, as a feminist and, you know, and someone who writes about politics a lot, you spend a lot of your time talking about diversity, and diversity sounds like an incredibly boring word. But the whole thing about diversity, it's not like a noble luxury that we can sort of, you know, indulge in if we feel like we're doing everything else. It's just more business. It's just more stories. It's just more fun.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't want to hear the same stories over and over again. I can't be the only one who sits watching most TV and you can kind of guess what's going to happen next.
Sure.
So, you know, that's the whole idea about having, you know, people from, and also people who've never written before, come up with crazy ideas. Yeah. Like, kind of, the amount of times that we made people very terrified when we were making Raised by Wolves. For instance, in one episode, Jermaine, the 16-year-old, who is overweight and sex-obsessed and bumptious and joyful, reacts to the death of her grandmother by deciding that she will discover masturbation and basically wank away the pain. And we decided that she would be doing this when, in the TV in the corner of the room, Question Time was on. And because that music gets kind of ding 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 ding. I mean, it builds. It's kind of, you know, it is like, call it a masturbatory aid. And so we joyfully write this scene, and then the producers go, yeah, but you're going to have to get permission from Jonathan Dimbleby because it will end on a close-up of his face. And, like, we can't... That's just wrong. He will have to get his permission. So I sort of know his son vaguely through Twitter, so I just had to send him a letter to give to his dad. I said, can you give this letter to your dad? Which said, this is a bit weird, but we've written a sitcom where a 16-year-old girl wanks to the Question Time theme tune and it ends on your face. And... And 2 days later, he just opened this book going, oh, that's absolutely delightful. Absolutely, of course. That would be wonderful. And similarly, we had... It's a family that is obsessed with cheap food because that's what you're obsessed with. Then you're poor; it's one of your few joys. And so they eat a lot of cheese, and they've come up with a song called "Cheese on Cheese," which is where they've repurposed "Girls on Film" by Duran Duran. So the lyrics now aren't about sexy models, but it's about cheese on cheese. I'm making a sandwich, cheese on cheese with cheddar and Leicester, because it's a cheese on cheese sandwich. It's cheese and then cheese and then cheese. There's no bread; it's just pure cheese. And again, they were like, this is a great song, we're all singing it in the office, but you will have to get permission from Simon Le Bon from Duran to do this. And again, luckily I know him through Twitter, so I was like, hello Simon, this is a bit of a weird thing, but can we take your song about sexy ladies and make it about very cheap cheese? To which he replied, yes, that's brilliant, hey, up the Midlands, hurrah and hooray! It was very jolly and not new romantic-y about the whole thing.
That's good. Yeah. but it's sort of interesting, I think, to see... Well, it's exactly that, it's because I think in the past... I think sitcoms, you know, a lot of sitcoms that get commissioned are that very formulaic thing.
Yes. And happened in the hall.
And they're written by the same kind of people.
Yes.
So I think it's very exciting that, A, like, I think you've made this point, but certainly in America, so much of the new comedy stuff is being written by women that it's almost like, where are the men now?
I know. I feel sorry of men, kind of like, yeah. But it's amazing how many of them are working with Judd Apatow as well. I presume that he just stands by the toilets, the ladies' toilets of the Golden Globes, and just anyone who's going in, like, want to make a film with me? He's kind of like, you know... Gets Schumer, gets Faye, everyone.
No, so it's very interesting. I think the other two that have come from a theatrical background, they're really, you know, they're standout, amazing, just so different.
Yes, Fleabag's incredible.
Fleabag's great, but this is as well, because it's, I guess it's, you know, aside from Mrs. Brown's Boys, which I'm not sure is that accurate a portrayal of working class life.
At At times. I did find my dad in a dress in the front room, but talking in an Irish accent, but that was just simply a good night in the pub.
Yeah, but there aren't many, you know, there aren't many sitcoms about your family is a very unusual family,
yes,
from Wolverhampton, and but it's that working class thing, and they're not trying to scam the state and
not being a shameless thing.
Well,
this is the thing, kind of like the, you know, sort of the depiction of the working classes is generally around them being kind of almost like kind of dangerous, kind of exciting animals, and they're always just having sex in an alleyway or dealing drugs or setting fire to cars or kind of like saying things in slightly impenetrable slang. And it's like there's a bit more to being working class than that. But you know, first of all, we've forgotten about the aspirational working classes, that post-war thing of, you know, educating yourself. You go to the library, you know, you take care of things, you have conversations about culture, you're engaged. You know, this is one of the problems that I had with Benefit Street. It was all just about survival.
Yeah.
And yes, you know, when you're very poor, that is, you know, a key thing. That's, you know, that's the plots of your day, is trying to work out how you're going to get, you know, for instance, your washing machine breaks down, you can't mend it, you've got a cousin who's got a spare washing machine, but they're on the other side of town, and you've got to work how you're going to bring a washing machine from Cannock to Wolverhampton on a bus. Like, kind of, that's, you know, it's practical, yeah, everyday things that you're having to do. But at the same time, you know, the, you know, things like Benefit Streets, you never see people talking about anything other than survival. It's almost like you're reduced to a body, you're reduced, yeah, to a problem. No one's allowed to be silly or surreal or fanciful or whimsical. So, you know, that was very much what we wanted to put in there. So, you know, there are intellectual, bohemian, working class people. It's, yeah, kind of, you know.
And they're really excellent characters. The mother character's amazing. So it's this, you know, attempting to, well, there's six kids, are there, in the fictional family?
We were never sure. Kind of. At one point, we wanted all the children to be played by puppets instead. We were just like, they should just be a mass. That's what little children are like, just, yeah, little Muppets.
They're, yeah, just called the babbies in, yeah, the titles, which I like. But it's a great portrayal of someone just they've got to get on with their life. They've got this impossible life.
Yes.
Because they're a single parent with six kids, and she's getting on with it, and she's... there's just a great focus of that character. It's an amazing character.
We'd written her very differently, and then this is where you start realising actors are kind of amazing, because we'd written her as quite uptight with kind of GHD'd head and stuff, and kind of very particular about how her cushions were arranged on the sofa. And Rebecca Staton turned up, and she went, I don't want to name drop, but I do. I've just come off set with Clint Eastwood, and I want to play this mother like Clint Eastwood. I want to play her like the lone cowboy in town, kind, yeah, of like a superhero, just kind of a preacher man. And we were like, yeah, that is what single mothers are. You know, you are, yeah, a freaking superhero. And, you know, so then we wrote her like Ripley from Alien, you know, kind of, she's very Sarah Connor in Terminator, but on a council estate. And, yeah, that is basically, and I found it was amazing writing a character like that, because, it, you know, she didn't inspire us to write her like that, because I now parent like this fictional mother,
right,
that I wrote. It's kind of, you know, to the point where my children get very annoyed.
There's an element of that with it. However many kids you've got, and however easy your life is as a parent, there is this, it becomes about your family's your focus, and you just have to get on with it. You,
yes,
know, your life has changed irreversibly.
And for the worse in many,
yeah,
ways, yeah.
There's no
But I mean, part of the joy of that is kind of, you know, you're kind of this feeling that you can't, I mean, you know, if you like being funny and that's your way of getting through life, kind,
yeah,
of, you know, the thing that Della can just do these brilliant speeches, you know, you just get to rant, kind of like, yeah, okay, you're going to have to do some parenting at some point, but before you do, you're going to let the kids know how much you resent it.
Yeah,
and I really enjoy writing those speeches. They are from the heart.
And then I think what's most interesting about it is you write with your sister Caroline.
Yes.
And the two central characters are clearly very much based on you.
Based on us, yes.
And they're quite different,
yes,
people. So it must be very hard for those two people to write a sitcom together,
well,
even if they weren't sisters, but, you know, they're very different.
Well, for those who haven't seen it, the two main characters, there's one overweight brunette who's very confident, very extrovert, never stops fucking talking, is obsessed with Benedict Cumberbatch and wanking. And then there's another character who's a ginger, introvert, uptight, Marxist, obsessed with George Orwell, who hates the brunette. And I'll leave you to guess which one is me and which one is my sister. But it was, yeah, no, it was very interesting writing together. Kind of, when we first started coming up with the characters, I was like, I think Jermaine should be this kind of like, yeah, you know, she's bumptious and she's sex. But I think she should be noble. I think maybe she should be talking about politics. She should be this kind of great guy, like really inspiring and noble and incredible and just a really inspiring and noble and really great. And my sister just went, yeah, or she could be a dick. And we argued about that for many hours, and, yeah, and many, many times I would just find myself shouting, I'm going to tell Mum about this, but that doesn't really cut it in a writing partnership, and Jermaine just ended up being a dick. Whereas the ginger one continues to be really noble, have much better plots, and much better hair, so I sort of, you can see the power struggle is acted out on screen, definitely.
But again, I mean, I think any well-written family sitcom is going to be great, because we all have that relationship with people in our family, however
yes,
different the families are.
Yes.
So that's an instantly recognised, you know, competition between the two oldest kids.
Well, it's the perfect cage, isn't it? I mean, you are all stuck together. And again, particularly if there's a lot of children, you're very poor and you're in a very small house, like you literally can't go away from each other. And there's this weird thing, kind of, you only get it in sibling relationships where you sometimes really want a sibling to punch you. You will just keep going up into a child, you know, just into a sibling's face and just touching it and just touching it. My sister used to do this thing that would drive me crazy where she would go, I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. Yeah, but I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. And you'd be going, Mom, Mom, Mom. She went, I'm not actually touching you, though. Look, I'm not touching you for 2 hours. And she wanted me to punch her. And sometimes you just want to wrestle with a sibling. Sometimes you would... And, you know, we didn't have television in those days, and the internet hadn't been invented, so we invented many games. And also, we were home educated, so we were quite stupid in many ways. So for some reason, we thought that your vagina was called your navel. And so when Sarah Ferguson married Prince Andrew, who was described as a naval officer, we just were in... We still haven't really recovered from that. And because we often had to share beds, we would do a game called navelling, where you'd be top to tail in a bed, and you'd just try and put your foot up your sister's vagina. You'd just go, and if you did it, you'd go, navel, 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 navel. And that was, and that's what people did before the internet. That was a great day.
Well, it's very enjoyable. I watched the first
navelling, have
but
you
I watched,
done it too?
I know, yeah, it is, yeah. Well, that's... Anything, when you get to my age, anything. It's the hardest part of me, my foot, so that's fine. But it's... but it's... I think you will be successful with this thing, but you're going to... I think the thing that I did that has made the last two work...
Yes.
...is just you've got to be so persistent about it and just keep on going on and on about it, to the point that I'm sure... I've lost thousands of followers and fans and stuff from other stuff.
And what proportion of people do you need to sleep with who are funding it? Because I'm averaging around about 17% at the moment, but like kind
my
of...
My wife wouldn't let me sleep with any of them. I was prepared to do that for £1. I'd give you the pound. I think, but it's interesting because you look at it and you think, oh, it's a huge amount of money. But then I think, but actually, it's sort of 50,000 people giving £30. It gives you like about £1.5 million.
So we had a million viewers. So it's just kind of if they all give us a quid. But like kind of, aside from the fact that I would like to keep making the show, like first of all, if it works in this country, which it hasn't done before, it would mean that no show needs to die. Like so long as there's a fan base there who still want to make that show, even if a broadcaster takes it off, the fans can get together and go, no, we want to continue making this. You know, the writer and the cast are still there. We want to get the band back together now, which, you know, and I've got a list of things that I would bring back and want to kickstart. So, you know, so that's the first thing about it. And secondly, again, if it works, that's just a template that anybody else can take and work with. And I will come around to give you all advice about the best way to do this. I can tell you all the mistakes that we've made. But it's just a really interesting way around of doing it. That instead of having to wait for someone to believe in you, you could just make a thing happen. And that's magic. That's what you should be using the internet for, rather than just dick pics. So I've stopped doing dick pics. I'm all about the altruism.
But it's sort of, I mean, I got it with my ones, which were more modest than yours. You know, people going, well, why don't you pay for yourself? I put my Kickstarter things this year have been £170,000. And I'm not doing badly at my job, but if I paid £170,000 to do some work that I'm not getting paid for, I'd be in quite a lot of trouble. Yes. So you know, it is literally just the other way around. So I said to somebody, but you go to see a millionaire comedian and they charge you £50 a ticket, you don't go, well, you've got loads of money, why are you charging £50 a ticket?
Yeah.
You would happily do that. So it's just getting the money in advance so the thing can be made. And if you don't want it to happen, it doesn't happen.
Well, yeah,
so
it does seem weird that you're just having to explain this really basic thing that humans have always done. It's like, it's not begging. It's like, if you want the thing, then pay us to make a thing. Yeah. Like, as you do with everything else, like, kind of, it's, you know, we're not spending it on guns. It's kind of, it's literally, if you want us to keep making the show that you like. And if you don't, that's great, because then we don't have to. And I can get on with Billennium, like, kind of.
Well, I felt like that as it occurs to me. I thought, no, I'd never make £100,000 for that, and that would be fine. I could say I was going to do it and then have to do it. Now I've got to do it, and it's quite annoying, I have to say. It's taken up a lot of my time.
You're being very brave about it.
Thank you. So I've got some new emergency questions.
Excellent.
I'm going to ask you this one that's nearly new.
It's one of the questions, can you put your entire hand into your mouth, Catelyn?
Well, I can ask that. Can you put your entire hand into your mouth?
That's a weird question to ask. Why don't you ask me that? Yes, I can. Hang on.
Wow. In a way, I wish you hadn't been able to do it. That would have been an even weirder question. Just, I can't know. I'd love to see something. That was amazing.
Thank you.
If you had to do a human centipede with two other people, if you had to, but you could choose the two other people, and you're in the middle.
That was going to be my question. So it's, I need someone that I like pooing into my mouth, and then someone I hate strapped to my
arse. Exactly, you've got it. Everyone else hasn't really got this.
Okay, whose shit would be delicious is basically what you're asking me. Who do I think has a brilliant diet? Well, I mean, judging by the last series of Nigella, she's eating a very lovely, healthy diet now. Bottom would be a pleasure to have your nose rammed into. Yeah. I think I would absolutely... Yeah, I can happily spend so my lips to... Nigella Nelson's anus. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So that would be in front. And then who would I shit into the mouth of?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I feel that he shits into my mouth culturally, so it would probably be Simon Cowell.
Okay.
And that is a cheap gag, but I really mean it from the heart. He's the only person I regularly attack in print. Anyone else, no, but I just think with his £7 Mr. Topper's haircut and the palpable air of only having 7 CDs in his collection, 2 of which are the best of Robson and Jerome, is... And his wholesale stealing of the concept of music being on television and the idea that being the karaoke Sauron and us just being trapped in his tiny record collection forever genuinely gives me boils in my soul. So, yes, I'll shit into his mouth. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
That's all right.
Thank you.
I think he would probably die first as well. So for a while you'd be dragging his dead body around. But then you would die. But then Nigella Lawson, I think, would survive.
I think she'll live forever. She's never going to die, is she, Nigella? That would be gutting.
No. But it's all right for her. I mean, it's all right for the person at the front.
Yeah.
It's like mildly inconvenient.
Well, I guess also she's the only one that can talk, and she's got a very soothing conversational tone, and she knows an enormous amount about literature, so she could just basically read aloud to us while the rest of us just munch on shit.
And that would annoy Simon Cowell, wouldn't it?
He'd hate it, yes. It. Don't talk about Dante! Go! Yes.
But you have sort of cursed her to... it's sort of like she is being punished, so you've sort of slightly punished her, but she would...
Well, I mean, you know, we all hurt the people we love, don't we? That's what I've learned from the human centipede. I once did a photo shoot with her where she had to dress up as me and I had to dress up as her.
Oh, right.
And I can tell any woman in the audience that's an incredibly depressing experience because Nigella was the most beautiful me I've ever seen in my life. Like, Nigella is me. She was wearing a Doc Martens, sort of like tights, little cut-off shorts and stuff. And she looked insanely hot. I looked at her and just went, God, Catelyn Moran could be beautiful. Were she constantly played by Nigella Lawson? And then I just had to be this kind of dog in a dress Nigella Lawson, and I was just very bad at being Nigella Lawson. So don't, if you get that opportunity, don't. That's just be sewn to her instead in a human centipede. That's definitely preferable.
This is a question my wife suggested.
Oh.
Well, if you dropped your phone down the portaloo on Glastonbury on the third day... Would you retrieve the toilet? Would you retrieve the phone, or would you leave it in the? Now, I think my wife imagined that Glastonbury toilets are, you know, you can just reach in and grab it, but actually, it's pretty much a sewer under there.
Yeah,
isn't it? I mean, but she was with someone who did this and who did retrieve their phone.
Really? Yeah. And did it work?
I didn't get that. I can't imagine it did. And even if it did, do you want to hold that to your face?
I mean, my prosaic, non-funny 41-year-old answer is, it's all backed up to the cloud and I have an insurance thing. Of course not. But my amusing anecdote answer would be...
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One of the most noble things I've ever seen a celebrity do was we camp in the backstage Winnebago area at Glastonbury because we're wankers. And 1 year in the absolute pissing rain, we noticed that four doors, four vans down from us, Mark Owen from Take That was in the van and with a couple of friends and his heavily pregnant wife. And we sort of watched him coming and going, and he just had a very pleasant demeanour anyway. And then on the last day when you hire the Winnebagos, you have to empty the toilet cassette out. I don't know if you've sort of been in those caravans. We have to sort of pull out a big kind of cassette of poo and go and empty it down a toilet somewhere else. And on the last day of Glastonbury, in the rain, I watched Mark Owen from Take That just take the huge cassette of poo out of his caravan, volunteering himself willingly and cheerfully, and emptying out the collective shit of everyone who'd stayed in his van into the public toilets around the corner. And I was like, you don't need to do that. You're Mark Owen from Take That. Surely with your incredible wealth and fame, you could just go like this and have someone come over and remove the poo for you. But he emptied his poo himself. So given that he's so at home with poo at Glastonbury, I'd probably ask Mark to maybe retrieve the phone for me. Like, kind of.
I think that's how he got into Take That. He was prepared to do that for the other. So you can be in the van as long as you... We're all going to poo in a little bucket, and you have to get rid of it at the end of the week. Are you happy with that, Mark?
Yeah, that'd be all right.
Yeah, all right. I would imagine Gary Barlow does extraordinary poos.
Yeah.
I used to play this game with my husband where we tried to imagine the kind of poos that celebrities would do. Like, he was convinced that Prince would go behind the sofa like a cat and kind of emit pellets. He'd kind of scratch. And they just emit a lot of pellets.
Yeah.
Whereas I think we presumed from her vocal style that Heather Smalls from MP, but it would just be like, bah! Bah!
Oh, God. I wanted to look. Have you seen your YouGov, the YouGov page of your fans?
God, no. What? YouGov? Yeah. What are the. What
There's
is
a YouGov
Theresa
page, and it tells you what your fans are like. The typical Catelyn Moran fan and what they're different from...
Oh, hold on. I reckon I can guess. I reckon they're mainly fruity women who wear eyeliner, left-leaning, obsessed with Cumberbatch, and probably talk more about George Orwell than they've read of him, because that's essentially
I can show
me.
You a picture of exactly who they are. It's not so much fun for anyone else, but it's fun for you.
Is it literally a picture of... What? How
is this?
I'm
your
bamboozled
fan.
By technology. Are you literally showing me everyone who likes me?
They're readers of Catelyn Moran... that's what they look like. They look like that. They're...
Wow! It appears to be Janice from Friends. They've got they've got an average picture of mine.
They like eating hummus, which might. That used to be what my fans like, but they've moved on to something else. They're quite left wing. Not as left wing as my fans. They come from London, the North East.
All right, it's not
Wales.
A competition.
They've got a monthly spare of £1,000 or more, as have my fans. Which
spare?
Is, yeah, they've got £1,000 spare. So, that's
so they
good
could donate that to a Kickstarter.
They
maybe.
Could. Yeah. And they should.
Kickstarter/Raised by Wolves.
Yeah, they like. I'll tell you, the food they like is hummus. Chicken katsu curry, second, and butternut squash risotto, third. So if you turn up your gigs with that stuff, they'll be... Their favourite sport is athletics 100 metres, which seems very specific.
I mean, if they have the same build and feeling towards sports as I do, yeah. You're not saying how long it takes them to do that. And I notice that they've chosen the shortest run, which is definitely what I would do. Which you can just amble along doing while smoking.
And in entertainment, so let's see if they like Benedict Cumberbatch. In entertainment, they like... their favourite musical artist is John Cooper Clarke, which is an odd choice.
Really?
And the Flaming
I doubt
Lips.
This algorithm.
And their favourite TV show is The Great British Bake Off.
Not my fucking show.
And no.
What? How much do they actually like me?
No. Well, they like you on. They follow you on Twitter. That must be a relief.
Thanks, guys.
They like Bjork, Arcade Fire, and Joy Division's Facebook pages.
That is fair enough, yeah.
And lyricsmania.com is their favourite website. So that's I would just like you to know about that.
That's amazingly specific. I love it.
I believe it works on an algorithm which shows what they like that other people don't like, so it's not actually what their favourite thing is, it's just the thing that makes them different.
Most different.
Yeah, from
what did your fan look like? Mine looks like Janice
Mine
from
looks
Friends.
Like Andrew Collins.
Really?
Yeah. And it's changed since I last... The thing is, that's the depressing thing about getting old.
Is it actually Andrew Collins?
It might be. It could well be my only... not sure he's that much of a fan of mine anymore.
I quite like the idea of him setting up a proxy website that diverts everyone from YouGov to his own website to make you scared that he's your only fan.
Yeah. Oh, it's taken too long to load up. He's got a little satchel like Andrew and looks a bit like... And he's a middle-aged man now. But look at my... Look at the rich diversity of bearded men that like me.
Have you started to get to that thing now where you can't tell if someone young is good looking or just that they're young? Like, to me now, anybody like...
I refuse to answer this question on the grounds that it may incriminate me.
To me, anyone under the age of 35 just looks astonishingly beautiful. Like, they're lit from within like a stained glass window in a medieval cathedral. It's just like, they don't know about knee hurt. They don't know about unspecified lung stab. They kind of, they've never done that thing where you kind of pleat the skin on your hand, your arm, and it doesn't go back. They haven't got a wattle yet. I started to get a wattle. Yeah. And I kind of, there's that really famous Nora Ephron piece about, I feel bad about my neck. And so I sort of stood there in the window, just sort of in the mirror, just looking at my wattle, thinking, do I feel bad about this? Maybe I should feel... Nora Ephron felt bad about this. I should feel bad about this. But I decided I quite like it.
Right.
It's like, if you look at it, it's not unlike having a pair of knackers on your neck. They're just kind of... You just sort of wobble them backwards and forwards. Yeah. I quite like it.
The nice thing about being a man is you can grow... Which a woman could do, but not in the society we live in. You can grow a beard to cover a lot of the... I've just shaved off my beard today, so...
You've not got a wattle.
Well, it's kind of... There's some excess stuff under there that doesn't belong there.
Packing for the future.
It is. So I would like to hear about how you nearly broke into Kate Moss's house.
Ah, yes.
Because I found... You say you're talking about that and then I haven't found when it happened.
Oh,
so
right, okay. Yeah. Well, that'll be because it's on the Times website behind the paywall. Yes,
I refuse to pay.
There's such good, sweet stuff behind that paywall written by me. And no one knows about it, which is great because it means I get to tell the anecdotes twice. I went to you may have guessed from the conversation, I quite like Benedict Cumberbatch, I've had an embarrassing history with him because I got the advanced DVDs of Sherlock a couple of weeks before everyone else when I was still a TV critic. So on the night it first went out, I sort of popped onto Twitter and went, there's this new show called Sherlock coming, ladies in particular, I think you're going to enjoy this show, 9 o'clock, I'll see you there. And then the show started, I had a couple of glasses of wine and there was the first close up and I was like, this really is quality drama, as I stared at his beautiful face. And then there was the sort of second close-up 10 minutes later, by which point I'd had another glass of wine. And I was like, look at that sweet, sweet face. Made of marble, looks like a meerkat. He's beautiful. And then by the time there was his third close-up, half an hour in, I'd had most of the bottle of wine. And I just typed, oh my God, Benedict Cumberbatch. He could make my face look like a painter and decorator's radio. Press send. Unbeknownst to me, the entire cast and crew of Sherlock had gathered at the writer Stephen Moffat's house, and Stephen follows me on Twitter, and at the beginning was kind of going, oh look, Catelyn's tweeting about Sherlock, she's saying very supportive things about it being a quality drama. Oh look, Benedict, that's quite funny, she's saying something about your face being beautiful and made of marble. Oh. So I didn't know about all this, so then a couple of weeks later they sent me to interview Benedict Cumberbatch, and... And it was around about the time, because there's always a backlash against someone, so he'd been very successful, and then there was a big backlash against him for being posh. Everyone was like, he's posh, fuck him, he's posh, he's too posh, we hate him, he's posh. And he'd sent me this email just sort of going, I feel really bad about this, and I was like, how dare they say things like this about you, sweet prince, I will defend you, you're not that posh. And I'm supposed to be interviewing at his parents' house in the countryside, so I've got the train, I'm in a taxi, and sort of all the time I'm texting him, he's going, I'm still worried about them calling me posh, and I'm like, fuck them, you're not posh. And the taxi pulls up outside his parents' house, and it's a fucking castle. It's like... I kind of, it's got huge gates that you have to open, and as you walk up the beautiful crunchy gravel driveway, there's a silver Jaguar, a London taxi cab, and a third sports car of a type that I don't recognise because I'm a woman, and it's just like bloody hell. So I go to the front door, and because I'm meeting his parents and I'm essentially courting Benedict Cumberbatch now, I want to impress his parents, so I've got a bunch of flowers for his mum and a bottle of wine for his dad. I'm kind of sort of knocking on the door, hello, hello, but the house is so big no one can hear me, clearly all the maids are in the West Wing, so sort of through the letterbox again, hello, I've come to interview in the countryside, hello, could you let me in? There's nothing. So I start walking around the house trying to find if there's another access point past the swimming pool, past this incredible sort of ballroom all the time, going, bloody hell, this is an incredible house, and I just can't find any way in. And in the end I have to go, I'm going to have to go into the village and ask a local peasant, how you get into Castle Cumberbatch? This is, I cannot penetrate its solid walls. I need a trebuchet. And so I walk towards the nearest hovel in order to ask them how to get into the castle. And there's a man standing outside the hovel. And I realise that the man outside the hovel is Benedict Cumberbatch. At which point he goes, Catelyn, I've just been watching you for the last 20 minutes. Why have you been trying to break into Kate Moss's house? She lives next door. So unfortunately, we did not wed. That was it. It went quite badly after that.
Well, it's good. I'm just, you know, he had the offer, didn't he? He could have taken up.
Yeah,
so
he,
it was. That's.
I think I'd sold myself very well as a bride at that point. You know? I'd shown that I wasn't the kind of person who could break into a castle. Surely that's an attribute you want in a bride.
Do you find that being successful as you are, has that had an effect on the way people perceive you? Because it's sort of like it's interesting, I think, as people come through, like you're super cool, you break through, and then.
Then you have a backlash.
Well, then you become successful, and then people. And I think, especially when you're writing about stuff like feminism, that people are very competitive about being the best feminist. About the being the best at being equal to everyone.
No, totally. But being women, you can take them down quite easily. Yeah. It's just a simple fight or with hair pulling. Well, I guess, I don't know, I'm a lover, not a fighter. So kind of like, sort of, you know, whenever there was a scuffle like that, I just wanted to make jokes about it. Like, kind of, that's the great thing about not being an academic feminist, you know, kind of, ultimately, as much as I believe in feminism and equality and all these things, if it was funnier to make a joke saying that I didn't believe in it, I would. Yeah. That's kind of, you know, comedy is my mistress. I think the main thing has been coming from, I mean, although it's hard to believe, given that I essentially have a Victoria Corrin's voice, I do come from Wolverhampton and a working class background, and the main thing that you see people saying is kind of like, surely you're now middle class, like kind of, you can't say you're working class anymore, you must be middle class, you have a city voice and you live in a big house. And I hate the logic of that, because it means that as soon as a working class person becomes successful and earns any money, they get co-opted and stolen by the middle classes, which means that the only sort of defining appellations that you can put on the working classes is that they're non-successful and don't have a voice. And I don't believe that. And I also believe that culturally, there are differences between the middle classes and the working classes. As soon as anyone working class makes money, they employ everyone they know. You know, they always pay the bill for everyone because they know what it's like to sit around a dinner table and know that you might not be able to pay the bill. You know, they share things. They kind of. It was interesting recently. I was finding that Radiohead and Kasabian are exactly the same music. Right. So Kasabian are sort of working class band from Leicester, Radiohead a middle class band from Oxford. I love both intensely and dearly, but this seemed to absolutely typify the difference between the working classes and the middle classes. That, you know, Radiohead into sort of prog rock and fortet and all the same stuff, and so are Kasabian. But whereas Radiohead kind of make these impenetrable things and kind of have this kind of, you know, we're sort of, you know, sort of don't really talk to the audience, and they're kind of like, we build an impressive thing that's to scare you and to make you cry. Whereas Kasabian take exactly the same music and they're like, oh! And there was a quote from Serge from Kasabian, who'd been to see Radiohead, and he was just like, there were no birds on bloke's shoulders. That's a shit gig. You know, kind of, I wouldn't want to be in a band where birds didn't get on bloke's shoulders. And I was like, that's exactly it. They want to share it and make it joyful, kind of, you know, they're not, because it's the difference between the physical spaces you live in. If you're working class, you have a space straight out on, there's no garden, you just walk straight out on the street and you share your music with everyone, you can hear everybody, you all sort of share whatever resources you've got.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're middle class, you have a fence and a garden and you curate your house and try and make it impressive. And it's not like one is different, you know, any worse or better than the other,
yeah,
but one is less represented than the other, and I know which one I prefer.
Yeah. Do you find, well, like at the moment with the Brexit and Ugh. Remain stuff going on, and like there's a lot, but there's a lot, like there's a lot of there's this feeling that, well, the Gary Lineker thing is sort of like that he's being anti-working class by saying that he's, you know, doesn't want to have yes. refugees being kept out of the country.
Yeah,
and so there's this idea now that working class means, you know,
reactionary,
mildly racist, reactionary, yeah. not empathising with people, not being supportive. And that's not my... And then if you're anti that, you're being anti-working yes. class. But it's not my experience of... My grandparents grew up in Middlesbrough and,
yeah.
and exactly, it was all everyone helping each other, living in quite an unpleasant place, as Wolverhampton is.
Yes.
And,
good
and making
luck
the
with
best
your podcast
of it.
In Wolverhampton, yes. That's,
I think
yeah.
Middlesbrough is worse than Wolverhampton, though, to be fair.
We can find a better self.
But it's, you know, but empathy was the
working class
word
is die unless they stick together
yeah.
because they have to because there's
exactly.
not that much outside support. And you know, without being too kind of, you know, smoking of the marijuana and becoming paranoid conspiracy theory about this, like who does it benefit for the story to be now that the working classes are ignorant,
yeah.
that you know, that they are non-supportive, that they turn on against each other? You are dehumanizing the working classes when you start telling these kind of stories about the working classes.
Yes.
And I think it's very noticeable because it's a trope that is repeated again and again through history. If you have a demonized underclass that is starting to get restless, which is what's been happening with the white underclass in this country, then you know, they're either going to rebel upwards and have some kind of revolution against the people who've got the money and the power. So what you have to do is make a subclass to the underclass, which in this yeah. case is refugees and people of color, and direct their anger downwards. And that's just a simple direction of energy. Like that,
yeah.
that's 101 politics. That's 101 Machiavelli. That's 101 fascism. That's what you do.
Yeah.
You don't want people kicking up. You want them kicking down, and you have to create a subclass. And that is the narrative that is unfolding at the moment. But my husband's theory on Brexit is that it wasn't that popular and people just voted for it because the word sounded like breakfast. And that's... And that's a word we love. And
yeah.
now, notice, obviously, it's full Brexit now, I think, continues this theme, that is, we just liked that word. And I think also the Remain camps, I think, it's about, so much of it's about words and stuff. Like, remain is like, you remain there. Remainders,
yeah.
like, and remains, like, and it sounds like skeletons and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas if it had been the stay campaign,
yeah.
stay is a beautiful word. When someone says stay, will you stay the night? Stay with
yeah.
me. You know, that's...
Niece 17 could have sung the...
Exactly, Shakespeare's sister could have been back. Like, kind of, you've... immediately, here, in
yeah.
1 minute, we've already got a better campaign that was fought by Remain. This is already better.
And you can't make it stay out, moan. You can't put
Ramonas,
moan in there.
I know. I'm loving this whole thing of like, kind of like the having had this cataclysmic thing happen, we're now shits for going, this is shit and this is going to be a terrible thing. Like, you're a Ramona if you're not 100% behind this. Like,
yeah.
why would I be behind? Why am I going to make your shit idea work? I just want to sit back and watch the whole thing fucking collapse. I'm going to do absolutely nothing. Your weird idea of turning Britain into a tea shop where we're going to, like, all our exports are going to be jam and biscuits and tea. People don't drink tea anywhere else in the world. Have you been on holiday anywhere else in the world, they don't do tea. Like, you know,
and we don't grow tea in the UK.
Yes. And most people don't like jam. If you talk to younger people now, like in our day, what better treat was there than some jam?
Yeah,
like 90% of the good stuff that happened in our lives from our generation was jam.
Yeah.
You give jam to a 9-year-old now, and they will say to you, as my daughter did at a birthday party when I'd made jam tarts, but why would people eat jam when there's Nutella? As far as she's concerned, if you were going to make a jam-like thing with a jam-like consistency, why would you make it out of strawberries or black currants when you could make it out of chocolate instead?
Yeah.
And she has an enormously valid point.
Yeah. Yeah, Nutella's not made in the UK. I said, I'm going to get... Ali's going to ask a question now. This is my... He's from the 19th century, so I have no control over what he will say. I apologise. Hello, Kathleen. Aren't men much better than women, though? That's the thing. Oh, Ali, that's very rude. But he has a point. Isn't that the craze that men are better than women?
Well, one of the great things about women is we do know how to condition our hair, which is
yeah.
something that Ali has clearly not done. The last time I saw... He has hair as dry as... Oh, God, what's her name on the Great British Bake Off? Who's the one on Great British Bake Off who's got really dry hair, that woman? Is she Anne? I've been Jane, yeah. I knew the women would know. Like, kind of any woman I know who's watching it's just going, just condition it. Just put a leave-in conditioner. It's so
well done, Ali. You've got them turning against each other. That is well done. Your work here is done. I believe women should be treated as if they're equal. That is what I believe. So that is... I'm very different than... Very different. Yeah. We haven't got too long with you, so I'll ask you a couple more emergency questions. Have you ever seen a ghost?
Yes.
Yes, I knew you would have done it.
When my granddad died, I shared the room with my five siblings. We had two bunk beds and a mattress on the floor, and on the night that he died, the cord from the light started swinging very slightly like this. And we all screamed and went, that must be Grandad. Not taking into consideration that it was the middle of January and all the windows were open and that a swinging light switch would be a common thing to see. It was absolutely, we believed that that was a ghost. Still now, we believe the Grandad spirit was in that light cord.
That's the kind of thing he would do, I reckon.
If he came back.
He's
a gentle ghost.
He was nice. But you chose your name through numerology, right?
Yes,
Your real name was Catherine.
Yes.
And you decided that wasn't going to get you anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's worked, hasn't it?
Well, arguably. This is the thing. I know. Maybe those Egyptians were onto something. I just thought Catherine was quite a boring name. And so I read a Jilly Cooper book where there was a character called... The thing is, you should pronounce my name Caitlin, like, kind of, but when you choose a name when you're 13 from a book and you don't really go out much, you will pick a name and completely mispronounce it for the next 30 years of your life and make people feel really awkward when you say it's Caitlin. It shouldn't be. I've got no reason to say to them, this is called, you should call me Caitlin. Yeah. It is Caitlin. I picked it out of a book and then I checked it against numerology. But I think I'm watching my daughters go through the same phase now. When you get into your teenage years, you really get into the supernatural. Like, I can remember the supernatural section of the library. It was like, because you're like, I know the grown ups know stuff and they're keeping it from me, and then you find the shelf of books about UFOs and the Pendle ghosts and you're like, that's where the secret stuff was. I knew that the grown-ups knew about this stuff. Yeah. So I was obsessed with the supernatural, as my daughter is now. And at the height of my insanity in believing in the supernatural was I became convinced I was psychic, and when the band Squeeze toured Wolverhampton and played at the Civic Hall in 1989, I was convinced that if I lay in bed long enough looking at a picture of lead singer Glenn Tilbrook, whom I believed would be the most psychically receptive. And I kept looking at a picture of his face and repeating my phone number over and over again, 01902-337-326, that he would, in his dressing room, go, I don't know why, but I feel like I've got to call this number. And then would call my number and go, do you want to be on the guest list for tonight? And then I would go, yes, that has worked really effectively. And as you may imagine, that did not happen. But I was genuinely convinced that he would ring. And
now you've given your number out on this podcast. He might listen to this and then he might ring you.
Finally. Yeah. It'd be like Ghost. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I was very much, I mean, I still sort of am. I'm quite logical and rational and don't believe any of this stuff. But in my teenage years, I was obsessed with... That's why all the things I'm interested in, like Jesus, who I'm interested in in a non-religious way, and Nostradamus and Rasputin. I mean, they all have beards. That's the other thing. I loved that kind of supernatural element of all their lives. Obviously, you know, Jesus was pretty magic, wasn't he? Came back. He was a ghost, wasn't he?
Well, I guess, superheroes weren't around so much at that point, so the fact that you're kind of like slightly magic men who are more accessible than Batman, kind of, that was what spoke to you. I like that.
I never understood why Jesus' disciples were so suspicious of him and didn't back him up all the time, right? Because, like, they must have known he was the Son of God and they'd seen him do all the miracles and stuff. And then still Peter's going, no, I don't.
I don't know him.
And Dom was going, yeah, I don't reckon it's you. Why don't you reckon it's me? You remember when I walked on water and I brought Lazarus back to life? Nah. Remember that I'm the Son of God? Yeah, nah. If Thomas can't believe in Jesus, how the fuck am I meant to believe in Jesus?
I presumed it must be because all the disciples come from the Midlands, because they doubt everything. Like, you see anything amazing happening, you go, nah, I don't reckon. That's the default Midlands.
Would they follow him around for though? Anyway, we'll follow you around, but we don't.
But by being constantly sarcastic and dolorous, yes, absolutely. I don't really know that much about Jesus. Everything I know is entirely based on the score from Jesus Christ Superstar. So
well, that's pretty much it. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Really, he did some singing.
did some good singing. What was it like being... I mean, why were you homeschooled? Was that a choice of you or your parents? Or...
Well, they were hippies, and they'd asked us if we wanted to leave school a couple of times, and we were sort of... Because we were hippie children, we were kind of going to school in sort of rainbow crocheted ponchos and gold Wellington boots, whilst everybody else was wearing neon pop socks and being into Duran Duran. So we were bullied quite a lot. and our parents asked us if we wanted to leave school, and we were like, that would be great. And there's two ways that you can homeschool. Like, half the people who homeschool do it because they think that you'll get a better education at home. And, like, you know, if you just go for a walk with your parents, you will be through the woods. You'll be learning about geology and geography and kind of, you know, nature and all this kind of stuff. And it would actually be a better way to educate children. That would be a better way to educate people. And then there's the second sort, which is my parents, who just really couldn't be bothered to get us up every morning and to find clean socks and pants. And so, as a consequence, they did nothing at all. And we would wake up every day and we would watch classic MGM musicals whilst eating a huge amount of cheese. We invented the cheese lollipop, which is a fist-sized lump of cheese on a fork, which if you're bored enough, you can lick. You can lick cheese and it will gradually... Have you ever licked cheese for a very long time?
I haven't licked cheese for that long, so I don't know. Yeah, I find it too delicious.
Well, if you had you been as bored as us, you will realise that it goes through a very odd journey. As you lick it, the sort of the more liquid elements of it kind of like get licked away, and you're left with kind of little lumps of more solid cheese and salt, which you can then crunch on as individual delicious nuggets before going back and penetrating the rest of the more liquid cheese. And that's but that will be over 3 or 4 hours. You can't.
Yeah, of course.
That won't happen straight away.
You have to be committed.
Yes.
But it's amazing. I mean, I'll let you go very soon. But it's amazing that you went from that, and then you obviously had this observer success, and then you were kind of straight onto teaching. You did Naked City,
in which I was appalling. Yes, I was the world's worst. I was given a TV show at the age of 18, and there's a reason why not many people say that sentence, and it's because it's a terrible idea to give an 18-year-old a TV show. I had nothing to say. What have you got to say when you're 18? I literally didn't know, and I would be going around the world interviewing all these pop stars, and I didn't have any clue who they were, because at the point where I became a music journalist when I was 16, I had 12 CDs from the local library. I was blagging my way through the whole thing. So I went to interview Iggy Pop, had no idea who he was, and just talked to him about his hair for half an hour. But the thing is that because everybody else that interviews Iggy Pop is usually kind of a boy fan who's kind of like, oh my God, tell me all about the Stooges. Iggy was thrilled that I wasn't asking him about self-mutilation and the Stooges, and we talked about hair for half an hour.
Yeah.
And his secret then, which is the bigger thing now, is that he said, I always put the conditioner on first, then use shampoo.
Don't think that would work.
Wiggy Pop.
Either so, because I, me and Stu interviewed Moon Unit Zappa in Canada in the late 90s, and I don't really know anything about Frank Zappa. I didn't even know he was dead, to be honest. So I was, she was talking about, and I was going, your dad sounds horrible, but she really liked it, because obviously everyone else,
it's like,
well, everyone else is just like, you know, and looking back at it, I now realise she quite fancied me. It's terrible when you go back and look at it. She came up to me on the last day, said, write this down. I said, and it was her phone number. And I said, and I was too stupid to understand.
What did
that
you
was
think? What?
I don't know, she was lovely as well.
What would you think she was giving you her phone number for?
Just because I would just assume she couldn't be interested in me, so that she was just being nice.
Surely you'd been
but
through
now I've
the human
the
ritual.
She definitely fancied me.
Really? What, is she all like this?
Yeah, because she's all like, I'm laughing at how funny I am and cheeky I'm being. It's pretty much the story of my life. I'd like to be able to go back and have another crack, really. Not just at Moon Unit Zappa, but that would be a start. It's called Moon Unit. That'd be good, wouldn't it? Going, oh, when you're having sex with her, oh, Moon Unit. Oh. You don't. She wouldn't have liked that.
But then when you were younger, you don't realise. I had a similar thing with Jeff Buckley. I'd interviewed Jeff Buckley a couple of times. I got on enormously well with him. He was just really funny, kind of, you know, you drowned saint-like man now. But he was just incredibly funny and really silly. And then one night, he just rang me and said, I'm in town, I'm at my hotel, do you want to come over? And I just put on a toweling robe, and I was watching The Crystal Maze. And I was just sort of, and I'd skinned up a joint, and I was sort of halfway through it. And I was like, nah, there'll be plenty of time to fuck Jeff Buckley, that's fine. And then he drowned in the Mississippi, but a month later, I was just like, no. I mean, then the moral of that story is, always go and have sex with Jeff Buckley.
Because if you'd had sex with him, he probably wouldn't have drowned, because his future is sliding doors, isn't it?
That's exactly.
The sliding... Catelyn's
sliding doors. Yeah, he would have slid through my doors. He would have drowned in another way entirely.
If I got off with Moon Unit Zappa, the best thing about it would have been it would really have annoyed Stu. Never mind. Look, I know you've got something else to do, so thank you very much for coming in. Please support it's Raised by Wolves.
Raised by Wolves,
if you go on Kickstarter and search for Raised by Wolves, and just put a fiver in. If like it doesn't take that many people to get, it takes quite a lot, doesn't it, to get 300 pounds.
It's an extraordinary amount of money, but if you like it, then do it. If you don't, then that's absolutely fine. I'm starting to go off it, to be honest. So, but I mean, if you do want some more, we will make some more. Everyone's there and ready to go. So, and you get great rewards. You get cameos on the show. You know, you can have a personalised message from the cast that you can play at a wedding or a birthday party. Like, kind of, we've tried to come up with genuinely good stuff.
It's a really excellent show. It was really lovely to watch some more of it today, because it was it's really the relationships between all the characters are great. So I hope you do get to do some more.
Thank you.
If not, I look forward to the Bill Murray.
Millennium, it's happening.
And I'm sure there'll be much more to come anyway. But ladies and gentlemen, give a massive round of applause to Callum Moran. Listening to Richard Herring's That's the Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest Catelyn Moran. The music is by Pest. Thank you to everyone at Go Fast Strike. Thanks to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre. Thanks to everyone at British Comedy Guide. Thanks to everyone at iTunes. Thank you to my producer Ben Walker, and he'd never record. He's doing proper jobs. He won't come in and record these credits. He thinks it's too big for them. So thank you to George, whose arm is getting better. It's very nice to have him doing this. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. If you enjoy these, head to GoFasterStrike.com and you can pick up DVDs. My new DVD, Happy Now, might even be out by the time this goes out. Oh, no, it probably won't. And but there's lots of other DVDs there. Or go to richherring.com/gigs and you can see if my show, The Best, is coming near to you. Buy tickets for that. That's mainly in 2017. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to RichardHerring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.